Hello, this is Roman Gabriel, and you are listening to The Grilling Truth.
Welcome to the Grilling Truths NFL Legends Show, brought to you by Gridiron Mo, a new interactive football app where you get to call what you think the offense or defense should do during a live NFL game and see what all other fans have called also. Check out Gridiron Mo at www.gridironmo.com. As always, for the Legends Show, I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster, and right now I want to welcome in the quarterback for the 1966 National Championship Notre Dame, and also was around for two Pittsburgh Steelers, where I guess you got two Super Bowl rings, Terry. Help me welcome to the show, Terry Hanratty.
Well, thank you, Mike. Good to be here. I do have two with Super Bowl 9 and 10.
Yeah, that's not too bad of an accomplishment. Heck, Dan Marino would like to have one, Terry.
There you go. he was pretty good, though. He was pretty good.
Yeah, he wasn't too bad. And he grew up kind of in the same neck of the woods you did. I know you grew up in western Pennsylvania, steel mill town. You want to talk to us a little bit about what your early life was like?
Yeah, Dan was from Pittsburgh, I think Central Catholic, and my hometown, Butler, Pennsylvania, which is about 25 miles north. And if you look at the, you know, they call that the cradle of quarterbacks. I mean, there's been, you know, you go with Montana, Marino, Namath, Unitas, Blanda, you know, just a, you know, Jim Kelly, Hostetler. I mean, there's been a bevy of quarterbacks coming from Western Pennsylvania, and it was. Back then, you know, when the steel mills were going strong and when the coal mines were, you know, producing, you know, the people who worked in those industries bred big, strong kids. But now, you know, with the steel mills, you know, this thing of the past in the Pittsburgh area, and, you know, there's very little coal anymore. And, you know, it's a different atmosphere now. Back then, you know, football was the king. I would compare that to any, you know, the 60s and 70s to any area of the country where, you know, they talk now.
Yeah, it was like Texas or Florida is right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was just, you know, what was it? I had a scout one time say if you got the top 100 kids in the country, you'd have 10 or 15 of them from Western Pennsylvania. So that was, you know, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I think I saw where your high school coach coached, what, 61 guys that ended up going to Division I colleges?
We had in a 20-year period, he produced 62 guys in Division I.
Yeah, that's three a year. That's amazing.
It really is. I mean, we're talking big, and that's not including back then they had, you know, state teachers' college, you know, which are all around the Pennsylvania area. You know, you always hear Slippery Rock, but there's many more like that. But now they're all universities. But you know, a lot of kids played at those smaller schools too. So there was a lot of kids, you know, and if we always talk that. Of those 62 guys, probably about four or five could have afforded to go to college if you just went on a, you know, strictly academics. And so he put a good 58 kids, you know, gave them, you know, college education. So that's, you know, it's quite a feat.
So talk a little bit about your high school career at Butler, and when did you know that you had the ability to maybe play at a higher level?
Well, we had a different atmosphere than, you know, we had, you know, my graduating class was 980 kids. We were the second biggest high school in Pennsylvania. And it was typical, you know, there's a lot of, if people remember the, you know, the Woody Hayes days, 4 yards in a cloud of dust. And so you know, the quarterback really didn't throw the ball much. And, you know, I was, you know, I had the arm and all that stuff, but you didn't get to play quarterback until, you know, the kid ahead of you had graduated. So I played defense for my sophomore, junior year. And not till my senior year in high school did I actually start at quarterback, and we put up 299 points in 9 games. You know, that's in the early 60s.
Yeah, so, that's, you know, more than 30 points a game.
Yeah, you know, we were airing out pretty good. So, and, you know, we had a lot of success and all that good stuff. And, you know, then all the coaches start coming around and, you know, find out who the hell is this, you know, kid from Butler, Pennsylvania. So I only played, you know, started 9 games. Then the next game I started at quarterback was my sophomore year because you couldn't play as freshman in college back then.
Yeah, but before we get to that, what made you pick Notre Dame?
I was almost signed, sealed, and delivered to Michigan State. You know, I went up there a couple times, and, you know, Duffy and the guys came to Butler, and Duffy Daugherty was just a great, great guy.
Yeah, and, they had guys like Bubba Smith. I mean, that was a great program when he was there.
Well, they brought, you know, they brought all the black athletes from Texas up to Michigan State. You know, that was the pipeline they had there, and they had, you know, great talent. And, you know, so we had, one of the coaches at Notre Dame said, listen, you know, Ara Parseghian is going to be in Pittsburgh, which is 25 miles away, so could you meet him? So I went down to Pittsburgh, spent an hour and had lunch with him, and came home, told my mother I'm going to Notre Dame. I mean, he was just that classy and dramatic of a person that, you know, some person you wanted to be around for the next 4 years. And the hardest thing I had to do was call Duffy. You know, I'm thinking, oh, my God, what's going to happen? He's going to yell and scream, whatever, you know, this and that, this and that. But for the next 20 minutes, he went on and told me what a great school Notre Dame was, what a great coach Ara was. And he made a very difficult call for a 17-year-old kid very easy. So, you know, I've always appreciated him for that.
Well, I mean, that's what makes a great coach is somebody that cares about the kids.
Yeah, but you rarely see it anymore. You always, you know, you hear now.
That's why there's not too many great coaches anymore.
No. It's a dying breed, you know, coaches that spend 10, 15, 20 years at a school anymore. You know, normally, you know, I got 3 years, and if they don't have a national championship in their pocket, they're gone, or they're having some kind of NCAA violation against them, and, you know, it's a vicious cycle at this point.
Now, you talked a little bit about Ara Parseghian, one of the great coaches in college football history. He was a guy that came from Northwestern. Notre Dame's program was down. He turned them around pretty much immediately. What was it like to play for him?
He was, you know, I was his first recruiting class. And, you know, Notre Dame always had the talent. But they just didn't, you know, when Ara got there, he plugged the guys in the right spot. You know, John Hewitt never got a chance to play. And all of a sudden he wins the Heisman Trophy that 1 year.
Yeah.
He was with Ara. You know, Jack Snow, you know, he was the number one receiver in the country at that time. And they brought, you know, the offensive lineman, they put him on defense, they put the defensive lineman on offense. You know, he really just reconstructed the whole team. And, you know, except for a bad call out there in Southern California, he would have had a national championship in 64. And 65, you know, when my freshman year, you know, we had a great guy at quarterback who couldn't hit, you know, I don't want to say couldn't hit a bull in the ass, but, you know, Bill's Luck was a great guy, you know, he's a judge in Florida now, but, you know, and that's all they needed was, you know, a quarterback then. I remember sitting up in the stands saying, oh, man, I wish I could play on this team, because, you know, it's a great team.
Yeah.
And they had great running backs and great defense, and, you know, I remember Michigan State playing us at Notre Dame, and I think it was 12-3, I think, it was the score, 12-0 or something like that. I said, man, if you could just get, you know, a couple touchdowns, that's what you need to win this thing.
Yeah.
But then, you know, 66, you know, we put it all together. It was a lot of fun.
You talk about the 66 team, your sophomore year. What was it that made that team so special?
Well, we had everything. You know, we had a very, you know, there's only two question marks. That was Jim Seymour and myself. You know, we had
Seymour ended up being a great wide receiver.
Yeah, we had a great offensive line, we had great running backs, we had great defense. You know, our defense gave up, I think it was 2.8 points per game back then. I mean, we had shutouts galore all over the place, I think like five in a row shutouts.
Yeah, I think you guys for the year were something like 329-38 or something, weren't you?
Yeah, it was absolutely wild. And, you know, we went down and we played, I think, four top 10 teams. You know, Michigan State tied us. And we, you know, beat Purdue. We beat Oklahoma. We played down in Norman. We beat them 38-0 in Norman.
Yeah.
And I forget who the other one was. But
I know you guys finished the season. Then you beat USC like 51-10.
That's the other one. That's the other one. 51-0.
And the game everybody remembers is the 66 Michigan State game, and I know Ara takes a lot of heat for it. You guys were in a tie game with a minute to go on your own 30. But I think this, I don't know, maybe you can shed a little light on this, because I always wanted to know this. I know you got hurt early in the game, and so did your star running back, Nick Eddy. Do you think that had any effect on Arizona's decision not to try to get down the field in that last minute?
Well, it would have been, everybody forgets about it. The Michigan State punted the ball to us with, two and change to go from the 50.
Yeah.
Now, they were in a lot better place to go. They're at home. They're a lot place better to go for the win right there. And, we tried, Coley O'Brien was playing the game. He was my backup, and, I separated my shoulder in the first game, in the first quarter. And George Gedeke, our starting center, he got hurt. He was out of the game. Nick Eddy, slipped on the train getting up there and hurt his shoulder. He didn't even he dressed for the game but didn't play. And we just had a lot going against us, and we were on the road. We had a tie. We had the ball, I think it was on the 20, the last series, a minute and change to go. And we tried to throw, and Coley got sacked. So now, second and, we got 12 yards to go. And they got a kicker and kicked the ball 50 yards. That's crazy to put the ball up in the air. I mean, they had a lot better shot to go for it than we did. And
figured that he was he kind of did that just because he didn't have a starting quarterback in the game.
Well, that's also, but, you're still, even at that point, one little mistake and you've lost your whole season.
Yeah.
And we had Southern Cal to play the following week. So, we could, we were at Michigan State, so the game was tied. If you're number one,
Yeah, and weren't you guys down 10-0, in the first quarter or so? And actually came back
and tied it? Yeah, 10-0. We came back and tied it up. And, we went through a lot. Come back in that game. But it was, to this day, I still think it's the two best teams talent-wise ever to play each other. I mean, Michigan State had a ton of talent on that team, both sides of the ball. We had a lot of talent on both sides of the ball. And it was just too great. It was a nutcracker. I mean, that game was heavy hitting. And it was interesting, when you look back on it.
All right, so you touched on USC game the next week, but the rivalry has always got to me. I'm an Indiana boy. I mean, I grew up in the 70s, 80s cheering for Notre Dame. The Notre Dame-USC rivalry, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's sort of a mystery to me because I only played one game. That 66 when we won the national championship, I had a separated shoulder, so I was in a cast. Then my senior year, when I had knee operation, so when we went to California, I was in a cast on my leg.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Okay.
And my junior year, I threw five picks at Notre Dame Stadium.
We'll skip over to USC rivalry. Then,
I don't have fond memories. Two injuries in a horrible game.
Well, then 1969, you get drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers. I mean, that had to be an exciting moment for a Western Pennsylvania kid.
Yeah, coming back home like that, Steelers have had a rough go of it for the first 40 years.
Yeah.
So, Chuck Noll was his first year, and, Joe Green was drafted number one. I was drafted number two. And, I wasn't used to losing anywhere in major league, high school, college. But, the 69 was not a good team. We won 1-13. Won our first game against Detroit, then lost 13 in a row. So that was sort of a reality check about football there. So it was.
We had Andy Russell on the show about a year ago, and he went into detail on that season and Chuck Noll's famous speeches and everything.
We had. I remember we played up in Chicago. That was Chicago's only win, and first safety I ever got thrown for in my life, and we never crossed the 50. And in the fourth quarter, when they're up 38-0, they're still safety blitzing, and it's, weak side blitz, strong side blitz, all blitz, And it was we just couldn't stop them. And I know after the game, there was almost a fight on the field with the coaching staff. What the hell are you doing running up like that?
I didn't realize. I wonder if there's ever been two Hall of Fame coaches that both ended up with one-win seasons that played each other in that year.
Chicago
had Halas at the time, didn't they?
No, that was after Halas.
Oh, okay.
I think so.
I'm not sure. I know Halas retired somewhere around there. I know that.
Yeah. You might be right on that. I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure.
I might be wrong, too, though, after I think about it.
No, but it was just one of those things. I mean, we were horrible because, you know, the coaching staff just went crazy after each other. But onward and upward. But you knew Chuck had a plan. And Chuck was very deliberate. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. And, you know, that the plan was in place the second year. You know, he got rid of a lot of guys on the team. You know, Chuck never wanted to really trade for anybody because he didn't want to have to break someone of their old habits and teach them his habits.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't have to trade for people when you're having drafts where you pick up four guys and end up in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that was their real strength. We had great, you know, Art Rooney Jr.
Yeah, and that was actually my next question. I mean, what kind of man was Art Rooney to play for? Because I know every Steeler, and I've probably interviewed 15 of them, all of them absolutely loved a man.
Well, you came in the locker room after every game, and you never knew whether we won or lost. Because he would have the same expression, you know, good game, son, good game, ball, and he'd go around the locker room and, you know, patting guys on the back and, you know, saying, okay, you know. And it was just a joy to play for the Rooney family. You know, they have to be great when you look back on it and you think they've had three coaches since 1969. So they got to be doing something right. You know, if I was any college president or owner of a team, I'd say go spend a week in Pittsburgh, please, and talk to the Rooney family and see what they do, how they do things. Because, you know, they do it the right way. You know, they get the right people in there. They get good people in there, and they stick with them. I mean, Chuck, you know, for the first – think about it. There's many teams that hired a coach. Chuck Knoll came from Baltimore, who, you know, was a defensive coach. Nobody knew who he was. And to go 1-13, there, you know, half the teams in this league would have, you know, fired him right there. But the Rooneys knew something, and they just stuck with Chuck, and he had a plan, and obviously it worked.
Yeah, if you think about it, the next two guys they hired, Cowher and Tomlin, I mean, it wasn't like people thought they were slam dunk going to be great head coaches.
No, but they knew the blend that they wanted. And, you know, you give Cowher and Tomlin a lot of credit for what they've done. But Chuck really made the mold, and they sort of stuck with it, you know, with the big defense, strong defense, big running game, and, you know, quarterback play. And
I think Chuck Knoll's one of the most underrated coaches that ever lived.
Well, never, you know, he won four Super Bowls, never coach of the year.
Yeah.
And when you go with Steelers have won, when we won our first Super Bowl IX, I think it was 41 or 2 years, and we had never won a championship. So
yeah,
you think that
I don't
would
even
be
know
the
if
year.
They'd only been played like one playoff game, if one playoff game in the first four
years.
Yeah,
no, it was absolutely wild. Chuck really didn't want, you know, he had a TV show for 1 year, then he wouldn't do it anymore. It was just, you know, he just didn't like that stuff.
Yeah.
And he was a football coach, and that's what he wanted to do. He didn't care what you thought of him or anybody thought of him. There's one
so
guy.
So he would have been more in the Bill Belichick mold. He just wanted everybody to leave him alone so he could coach his team.
Exactly. And Paul Zimmerman from New York was the only one that could get to Chuck, because Paul also, for the New York Times, he wrote, and I think he may still write, he's a wine connoisseur.
Yeah.
So he writes a column on wine. And Chuck, at that time, was a mini wine connoisseur. So Paul played the right card and said, listen, Chuck, I'll come in, we'll spend an hour talking about wine, then we'll spend an hour talking about football. Chuck said, perfect, let's do that. So Paul used to come in and talk about the wine, and he would talk about football, and, you know, he got closer to Chuck than anybody else except for, you know, a couple local guys.
Yeah. All right, so 1970, we fast forward. You had been a second-round pick. The next year, they picked Terry Bradshaw in the first round. What were your feelings when they did that?
Well, you knew that, you know, the saying back then, you take the best available athlete. So it just happened to be in my position.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't run from competition. You know, when I went to Notre Dame, there were four quarterbacks, and all four were all state in their given state. You know, and no one left. like they do today. Everybody spent all the time there. And you just, you know, you compete. You just, you know, try to do your best, and that's about it. You know, there was no free agency back then, so you had no say where you could go, whatever. But, you know, you just kept your head down and keep working.
All right, so you were there in 72 when the Steelers, after all those years, finally made the playoffs. I mean, what was the atmosphere around Pittsburgh? I mean, a football-crazy town that had never seen anything like that. That had to be special.
It was really, really neat. And we won that first Super Bowl just to see the smile on Mr. Rooney's face. I mean, that was, you know, the ultimate. His cigar hanging out and that him holding that trophy, you know, that was really, really neat. And, you know, the people in Pittsburgh, you know, they're so loyal. And they're such good people. And they were just ecstatic about, you know, what we did. Then to come back and do it the next year was, you know, even crazier. You know, no one at that time, no one went back-to-back Super Bowls.
Yeah, and you got to take the last few snaps of that game, too, if I remember correctly.
I did, correct, yeah, down in Miami against Dallas.
Yeah, great football game. Dallas was a great team with a great coach, too, with Tom Landry. The Steelers-Cowboys were always great games.
Yeah, for sure.
And, I mean, we'll move on. The other thing I remember, I was like 12 years old, the movie Fighting Back came out about Rocky Blyer. Loved the movie.
Right.
I remember you were one of his best friends in the movie. I assume that it was like that in real life. You want to talk about Rocky a little bit?
Oh, well, Rocky's just one of the great stories. You know, he came back from Vietnam. You know, we played together in Notre Dame, and he was our captain. He was 1 year ahead of me. And when he came back from Vietnam, he stayed with my family and I. And, you know, he could barely walk. I mean, he tried to jog. It was a horrible limp. And the Rooneys were wonderful. They said, listen, Rocky, you know, we don't need you. You know, you don't need to do this. You know, we'll send you to law. They offered to pay for his law school there in Pittsburgh. And I kept telling Rocky, I said, go to law school. No, I'm gonna do this. I'm going to do this. And if you'd have bet me back then that he would have rushed for 1,000 yards in the NFL, I would have lost everything. But Rock was just such a great technician. You know, he's one of the best blocking backs ever to play the game. You know, he cleared away from Franco a lot. He had great hands. You know, he was not a burner, but, you know, he could get through the hole quick and, you know, get you yardage.
And he was always the guy that seemed to be at the right place at the right time in a big moment.
Yeah. I mean, he, you know, a lot of years. I mean, the odds for him to come back and rush, he rushed for 1,000 yards and he was collecting disability from the government. How's that? And
the government would let him do that.
You see the scars in his feet are just, you know, ooh, something to look at. So many surgeries. It's just
so quiet. I have to ask you this question because, I mean, to me, I'm actually a Bengals fan, so I hated the Steelers, but I respect the hell out of them, and I realize the reason I hate them is because they usually beat my team. But when you get to it, I mean, you played on maybe the greatest team in NFL history and possibly the worst. You want to tell us about your time with the 1976 Tampa Bay Buccaneers?
Well, not very much, no. But it was. I tell people, I said, no one saw the NFL like I did. My rookie year, we were 1-13, two Super Bowls, 0-14, my last year. It was just, I don't think anybody's ever seen the NFL like that. And, no, that was just, you know, I thought it would be a neat thing to do because it's such a young team and you can sort of mold things and, you know, help this, that. Then within about 5 weeks, I'm going, you know, just get this season over with.
Well, the thing people forget is up until the expansion, probably with the Carolina Panthers and was it the Jaguars, up until then, I mean, they made it very difficult on an expansion team to put a decent product on the field.
Oh, for sure. And it was, you know, you really took your lumps. And it was, you know, Steve Spurrier was, you know, starting. And I kept rooting for him. Let's go, Steve. Get him going. You know, John McKay thought, you know, it'd be when we played Pittsburgh. But he said, Terry, you're going to start this week. It'd be good to start about – good thing to start about your old team. I go, holy shit, what is this all about? And then we get up Pittsburgh, and we get up there, and these guys are just blowing through, and Joe Green would grab me and lay me down.
Yeah, LC, I think that ended up like 42 to nothing, didn't it?
Yeah, we never crossed. I don't think we crossed midfield. And at halftime, now these guys really took it easy on me. At halftime, John said, "You know, let's see if Steve can get something going in the second half. And they just kicked the shit out of him.
Oh, they didn't know Steve.
He came out and he said, he came out of the game and said, yeah, your boys took care of you. Oh, good old
but, yeah, I've always wanted to have somebody on a show to play it on the 76 Buccaneers team. But about the only ones I could remember were you and Steve Spurrier.
Spurrier. Yeah,
he won't return my calls. So you retired after the 76 season. What did you do with your time after that? Was it hard to make the transition from being a professional athlete?
No, I was ready because I hung them up when I was still 29 years old. And I did, I had played football since I was in fourth grade.
Yeah.
And it's just a regiment every year, you know, getting in shape, taking a month off, working out. You know, people see the games and they see the glory, but they don't see the stuff that goes on behind the scenes, all the running and lifting and all the stuff and the injuries and this and that. You know, that wears on you. And, I knew back in that time, you didn't make enough money where you could actually, retire. You know, so I just wanted to start a second profession. So I've worked about 30 years on Wall Street and, turned out well.
All right, so that wasn't near as violent as playing for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I guess?
No. No, I never took a hit.
All right, so do you still watch the NFL today?
Oh, yeah, I love football.
Because I've talked to a lot of players, like Robert Brazil's been on the show a few times. Robert doesn't even want to watch it today because he said it's a bunch of wimps. What's your take on the NFL today compared to maybe 1970?
I mean, if you slid back in the day, you'd get about four helmets in your back.
Yeah,
and if you ran out of bounds, I know people remember the Franco Harris used to, people criticized him for running out of bounds. Now every player runs out of bounds. But Franco, if he needed 1 yard, he'd go get it. But if he needed 10 and he could only get one, no, he's going to go out of bounds. Smart.
Yeah. Well, it extends your career.
Yeah, and in the grasp, no such thing. This guy buried you if they had you in a bear hug. I mean, it was so much more brutal back in the day. Just watch some of those old films. I mean, there's still big hits now. But back then, there were a lot more.
Yeah, but now the big hits, half of them are flag.
Hits. Yeah. A lot of them. Our whole defense, I don't think, could play today.
Well, no. It's like the all these Steeler fans give me crap about Vontaze Burfict since I'm a Bengals fan. And I'm like, didn't you ever watch Jack Lambert?
Oh, yeah. And
as violent as anybody that ever played the game.
Yeah, well, our secondary, they were. Those guys are, they would hit you big time. And, they changed rules because of Mel Blount. Mel Blount's still, I think, the best cornerback ever played a game.
Yeah, if he's not the best, he's in the top three or four. And the bad thing is nobody even mentions him. When they mention Deion Sanders, who's not nearly as good as him.
Forget it. He's 6'4".
Yeah, Deion Sanders never hit anybody in his life, I don't think.
No, Mel is 6'4", 215, and ran a 4.4 40.
Yeah.
And hit. I mean,
he had Donnie Shell, who was a hell of a player. I think he was after
Donnie
you,
Shell,
wasn't he?
And he would thump you. No, he was the same time.
Okay, Edwards.
Glenn Edwards and Mike Wagner. These guys were, they're going to bring the wood.
Yeah, I still think for my money that's the greatest defense I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think so too.
You had Hall of Famers all over the place. And then you got guys like L.C. Greenwood's not even in the Hall of Fame, but should be.
Yeah, it's a shame. He left us too early. Good friend.
All right, well, Terry, it was great having you stop in the show tonight.
Okay, Mike, listen, anytime.
All right. Thanks a lot, Henry. Or Terry, I almost called you Henry, Terry.
That's good. Close enough.
Yeah, what the hell. But all right, thanks, Terry.
But, okay, take care.
Anytime you want to come back, we'd love to have you.
All righty, thank you.
All right, thanks. Everybody, it was Terry Hanratty, former quarterback, Pittsburgh Steelers. I want to remind you all, you can go to thegruelingtruth.net, check out all of our articles, all of our Legends interviews. Over the last few months, we've had guys like Fred Biletnikoff, Cliff Branch, Robert Brazil, Matt Blair, Dennis Smith, Roman Gabriel, Kenny Anderson, a little bit of everybody, so make sure you check that out. You can hear all our shows on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Google Music, pretty much anywhere you find sports podcasts, you'll find the Grueling Truth. So for Terry Hanratty, I'm Mike Goodpaster. You've been listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.